quick. Turn up the sound.
You've discovered TalkZone.com, the best in internet talk radio. Now, more discussion of the issues facing you and your financial future. The Cyber Advisor, David Revelle.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back. I'm your host, Dave Revelle, and this is the October 9th edition of The Cyber Advisor. If you'd like to join us on the show, our lines are open. You can dial toll-free 888-463-6748. That's 888-GO-FOR-IT. Or reach me anytime on my email. It's dave@thecyberadvisor.com. Well, a brief announcement we'd like to make. The Cyber Advisor continues to be the fastest growing financial podcast on the net. In addition to our home at talkzone.com, you can now find our podcast on iTunes. Just do a search for the Cyber Advisor there and you'll find it. You can also find us on Podcast Alley, Digital Podcast, and Blueberry. So if there's a particular podcast directory you'd like to hear us on, just drop me a line, dave@thecyberadvisor.com, and I'll be happy to add it to our list. Well, our next story involves price and forward commitments. The genius of our free market system is that we set actual prices. We call them an exchange, and it's the place where stocks are bought and sold and the price is recorded. And that's important to remember. So an actual transaction takes place. Someone buys a stock, someone sells it, and that mark is called a price. But you might be surprised to know that that's not true everywhere right now. And the last few years has seen a big explosion in financial assets that are not priced that way. Some of these are non-liquid investments such as land, timber, commercial real estate, and certain derivatives. And they're almost always estimated to have a price. And a lot of those estimates involve a lot of long mathematical equations, often called quants in the business, but they are simply estimated prices, usually on some sort of a matrix. Now, recently, Stanford University has announced that that their endowment has been in deep trouble because of their investments in just these types of instruments. Specifically, they were investments in hedge funds. Now, one of the most interesting things to me, and this is true for almost all of the large endowments, all the large university endowments such as Harvard, Yale, Brown, Stanford, they have gone to a situation where there'll be an investment by an investment committee at the university. Most of them are investment professionals who in turn go through a selection process and diversify across a spectrum of assets according to a manager. So let's say they wanted to invest in equities. They would select a particular equity manager, likewise bonds, perhaps real estate, something more exotic such as, say, lumber or special real estate, and then some hedge funds. Now, Stanford got into trouble because they invested with a few hedge funds who not only used instruments that were not really priced, but also had cut a deal with Stanford so that Stanford, it was committed to buy more of the hedge fund as time went by. It was a forward commitment, and it required Stanford to buy more and more of the hedge fund. Now, if we look, there was a fascinating article written really recently in the Nonprofit News and Comment. And in that, the editorial actually speaks of particular interest was the difference in the amount of investment losses by some of the largest universities. Brown and Harvard lost the most, 30% down. Yale lost 25%, Dartmouth 18%, Columbia 15%, and Stanford, as it turns out, looks like they're going to lose somewhere between 27 and 30%. It's common knowledge that Yale and Harvard financial managers pursued high-risk investment strategies which involved non-priced assets, I will say, that in boom times brought spectacular returns, but did those same strategies contribute to the spectacular losses suffered by their endowments at those institutions. And given the fact that these endowments and the contributions to them were sizable, were subsidized by government, is there a reason to inquire into their investment practices? So what exactly was going on here? Well, one of the most interesting, or one of the people who was interested in this, is Andrew Skorkin of the New York Times. Andrew recently tried to describe how Stanford was trying to sell interest in these private equity, read hedge funds, private equity funds, after losing $4 billion in 1 year. They're selling both the equity position and the commitment for forward investments. They're committed to buy more of the hedge funds. Now, about 3 months ago, Harvard tried this same strategy, and they found that they could only get 29 cents on the dollar. That would mean a 71% loss, a hit so large Harvard was not willing to take it. But here's how Andrew Skorkin describes how Stanford is trying to struggle with this decision. Here's Andrew Skorkin.
This is, by the way, probably the biggest deal, oddly enough, going on in private equity. And it's not a deal where people are going to buy a company. It's actually the backside, if you will, of the private equity business, which is that private equity firms get endowments and other pension funds and other big investors to invest in them. And what's happened is people are coming into having either liquidity crunches or deciding, you know what? I shouldn't have committed that money to KKR or Blackstone or whatever it is.
No kidding.
And they can't get out of those commitments. So what's happening is there's becoming a secondary market, if you will. So people are selling their spot, both the assets, the portfolio, the pieces of it that they already own, mm-hmm. and the commitment that they have going forward. So
any takers?
The big issue. Harvard tried to do this earlier this year and found that people were only willing to spend 29 cents on the dollar for some of this stuff.
Ended up not doing it.
So here we have the definition of illiquid, the definition of an investment that it is almost impossible for you to get out of. And that's the investment in these hedge funds, these private equity funds that Stanford and most of the other endowments tried to do. Now, the reason they did it was they thought they were diversifying, which may very well be the case. But the lesson here is to avoid anything that is this illiquid, anything that does not have a price. It does not trade on a true and genuine exchange. Some of these hedge funds are traded on what they call a secondary exchange, but that's exchange in name only. Highly illiquid, highly difficult to get out of this. Skorkin goes on to be asked, are there hedge funds that are okay with this this arrangement of someone like a Stanford or Harvard selling their shares? And the answer is yes, but only marginally. Here's Andrew Skorkin again.
You know, there's become a secondary market, and it's allowed. So I wouldn't say they love it, because what it does is it does potentially depress the price if enough trading goes on. And so you did have Harvard try this. It didn't work out. CalPERS has said they'd like to do it, but now Stanford has put up $1 billion and possibly more, which would be the biggest secondary in the market at the moment.
Stanford has put up $1 billion of these illiquid shares, which they are now trying to get out of. A very, very difficult position, and obviously lesson one for any of us regular investors: avoid this type of illiquidity. Skorkin underscores this in his next comment, where he says what an illiquid investment this is. Here's Andrew Skorkin right one more time.
You could argue that private equity should only do better in the future, meaning investments that are made tomorrow or in the next year, assuming you think the market is going to go up,
right.
Those investments should be the ones that are paying off. And here you have Stanford and a lot of other, by the way, endowments that pushed a lot of money into the private equity sector as the boom happened, saying, you know what, strategically at least, I need to scale back. Some of these firms, some of these endowments had 12, 13, 14, 15% of their money in private equity.
Can you imagine 15% of your equity in an investment that you don't know if you can get out of it, or you don't know at any really given time precisely what the price is, because the price is not set by a transaction between a buyer and seller. Rather, the price is set by some quantitative analysis of what people think that it might be worth. Well, The lesson for us as investors, and it is a critical and important lesson, and it's one that comes around every generation or so. Those of you who were around in the 1980s may recall the popularity of limited partnerships, especially limited partnerships in, say, oil and gas, real estate, and some of the other things. And those of you going forward, we will no doubt see this come again. The point is, it is fine if you truly are in a position to have illiquid investments. That's perfectly fine. Then you can go ahead. But clearly the Stanfords, Harvards, Browns, Yales, people who thought that they could have large portions of their portfolio that was illiquid really could not be put in that position. And finally, the biggest lesson of all, never purchased any investment or make any investment in which there's an additional call on your funds. You may remember if you were in oil and gas that people were drilling an oil well and they needed more funds to complete that well, they could tap you on the shoulder and bring in additional funds. This is an extremely dangerous way to invest, and it is one of the problems that that faces Stanford in that they have a commitment, and it's not stated anyway. We don't know from their statements exactly what the commitment is, but you can bet that it is no doubt a sizable commitment to invest additional funds. Well, before we go any farther, I did want to bring your attention to what I believe is going to become the biggest story going forward in this economy. And it was reported on MarketWatch this morning, and it is that banks are cutting back on loans to businesses. MarketWatch reports that U.S. banks are reducing their lending at the fastest rate on record, tightening the credit squeeze and threatening to leave many otherwise viable businesses unable to borrow money to expand their business, meet their payroll, or refinance their maturing debt. Now, American business has, over the last few years, grown up on the ability to have readily available capital that was not equity in the firm. And we saw that a lot in manufacturing, where the just-in-time inventory allowed them to maximize their profit by buying parts from their subs to let them construct whatever their manufacturing was. This just-in-time manufacturing capability was all financed by banks and allowed U.S. companies to expand, and that is what they're talking about being taken away right now. According to weekly figures provided by the Federal Reserve, total loans at commercial banks has fallen at a 19% annual rate over the past 3 months, while loans to businesses have dropped at a 28% annual rate. In the first and second quarters, the U.S. private sector consumer the U.S. private sector, that is small businesses, consumed more capital than they raised for the first time in more than 60 years. Let me say that again. U.S. small businesses right now is consuming capital at a faster rate than they are raising capital or they can borrow capital. This negative net investment is, quote, the hallmark of a depression and difficult to reverse, said economist Lee Skain at Lombard Street Research. So this is the big story. I call it all to your attention. It is the fact that banks are not currently lending to small business owners. Why? The reason is small business owners are generally not the highest ranked or the highest rated people to loan to, and banks still have a tremendously large bad loan legacy portfolio that they have to work through. One of the big negatives on all of the programs that we've seen by the government so far has been their ignoring this legacy of bad loans, and until the bad loans come off of the book of the banks, we're not going to see the banks really stepping up and lending to small businesses like they need to do to keep this economy going. Well, let's take a quick look at the economic calendar. Let's see what came in this week and what we're anticipating for next week. This week, the ISM on Monday, the ISM services index came out, and it ticked marginally into the plus side. Now, the market expected it to be at exactly 50%. Remember, if it's below 50%, that's a contracting economy on the service side. This is the service side of the economy, ISM service index. Below 50% contraction, above 50% expansion. The market had really no anticipation. They just said it'll be a flat 50%. And in fact, it came in at 50.9%. The really one significant positive economic note that we had this week. The bigger news was consumer credit announced on Wednesday. The market expected consumer credit to be down, to contract at about a $9.5 billion, and in fact, consumer credit fell by a whopping $15 billion. That is a dramatic drop in consumer credit and indicates that the consumer is less likely to spend money going forward. I remind you that the biggest consumer quarter is coming right ahead of us, and it is the fourth quarter with the Christmas break and so on. So a $15 billion drop in consumer credit is not a good omen going into the Christmas quarter. Wholesale inventories continue to be managed, I think, very well by American businessmen. Consumer inventories were expected to be down 1%, and in fact, were down 1.3%. And finally, the trade balance continues to moderate a little bit. Expectations there for almost a $33 billion trade deficit. In fact, it was a $30.7 billion trade deficit. Well, what to look forward in the week ahead. On Monday, we will get an indication of those retail sales that we just talked about. The expectations are that retail sales will be down about 2%. Later in the week, we'll get the core CPI. Expectations are for a flat to a 0.1% rise in the CPI. We'll also see capacity utilization. Expectations are for capacity utilization to be about flat. Right now, our capacity utilization is only 69.7%, less than 70% capacity utilization, not a very good indication. And then finally on Friday, we'll see industrial production, which is expected to be just about flat. Well, that's it for this week's edition of the Cyber Advisor. We'd like to thank our producer, Dave Olson, and all the people behind the scenes at TalkZone.com. If you'd like to contact me anytime, my email is dave@thecyberadvisor.com. We'll see you next week, everyone. Bye-bye.